What's my most favorite thing to do? To talk. Every week I'll do just that. We'll feature national and international movers and shakers, experts in their fields, and all around interesting people with something more than great to say. No holds barred. We'll tackle every topic imaginable, especially for women over 40. This is Conversations with Sima. Please stay tuned.
This chair rocks. People are happiest at the beginnings and the ends of their lives. The vast majority of Americans over 65 live independently. The older people get, the less afraid they are of dying. Aging is a natural, lifelong, powerful process. So how come so many of us unthinkingly assume that depression, diapers, and dementia lie ahead? That the 20th century's astonishing leap in life expectancy is a disaster in the making? Underlying all the hand-wringing is ageism, discrimination that sidelines and silences older people. So I've written a book. I blog about it. I have a Q&A blog called Yo, Is This Ageist? Go ahead, ask me. I've written a consciousness-raising booklet, and I speak widely. All tools to help catalyze a movement to make discrimination on the basis of age as unacceptable as any other kind of prejudice.
We're listening to the words of writer and activist Ashton Applewhite, reading the face page words on her blog, This Chair Rocks, the same name as her book, A Manifesto Against Ageism. Ashton Applewhite is based in Brooklyn, New York. She is the leading spokesperson for a movement to mobilize against discrimination on the basis of age. In 2016, she joined the PBS site Next Avenue's annual list of 50 influencers in aging as their influencer of the year. Ashton has been recognized by the New York Times, National Public Radio, and the American Society on Aging as an expert on ageism. She blogs at This Chair Rocks, has written for Harper's, Playboy, and the New York Times. And she is indeed the voice of Yo, Is This Ageist? So welcome, Ashton.
Thank you.
So let's start by telling me a little bit about your journey, how you've come to this place, your life and work.
Well, I'm one of those people who could never figure out what to be when she grew up. So I didn't start writing till I was 40. I was getting divorced, so I wrote a book called Cutting Loose, Why Women Who End Their Marriages Do So Well. And there was a parallel there that I didn't realize till later, because I only see things in hindsight, that the catalyst for that whole book was a comment of my attorney's that more and more of his clients were women who were realizing they didn't have to stick it out in unhappy marriages. And I learned in 2 seconds that 2/3 of divorces are initiated by women. And I was amazed. I figured it was 98% guys, you know, dumping their tired, old, sad wives for happy, young, trophy wives. And so it was that discrepancy. Why don't we, you know, is marriage so terrible? Is life after divorce not so terrible? Why does that take me by surprise? 20 years later, I started a project interviewing older people who work. And they were amazing and incredibly, you know, engaged in the world in all sorts of interesting ways. And that didn't surprise me. What did surprise me was all the positive facts and far more nuanced. It's not that there aren't things about aging that are frightening and to worry about, but we never hear the other side of the story. And I realized that everything I thought I knew about aging was so much more negative and so much more absolute than what was actually true. And I thought, again, why don't we know this stuff? We don't know the stuff about marriage because we live in a sexist and patriarchal society, and we don't know the full story about aging because we live in a deeply ageist society that devalues people at both ends of the age spectrum. Ageism also affects kids, but society is so youth-centric that older people bear the brunt of it. And overlying the whole thing is, of course, capitalism.
So I know for myself that my 8 years as a spokesperson for midlife mothering and all of my work that I did was in direct correlation to feeling like somebody was telling me it wasn't okay to become a mother well over 40 and that anyone making choices outside the norm, whatever that would mean, would need to conform. So I'm just wondering, is the same pushback that you received, or is it because of the relative outcome of not accepting of who we are internally ourselves, the fact that you felt catapulted to discuss ageism?
Once again, hindsight being 2020, I realized that I started writing and thinking about aging because I was in my mid-50s, I'm 64 now, and I was frightened of getting old. And we live in a culture that equates youth with all sorts of good things, that gives more cultural and social capital to younger people. And it seemed really terrible to me that not only did you lose sort of your beauty, but, you know, you didn't even get to look forward to being honored as an older person. And it was that fear that got me thinking about it. But again, this huge surprise to me. I mean, I assumed that older people were depressed because they were old and they were going to die soon. Older people have better mental health than the young or middle-aged because of changes to the older brain that confer emotional resilience. We're better at managing our emotions. We're better at prioritizing. We're better at figuring out what we want. But it's funny, if you had told me 10 years ago that I would be captivated by aging, I would have thought, ew, you know, what a depressing, sad topic. And it is anything but. It is life itself. We are aging from the day we're born. So to write about aging is to write about how we move through life and how we interact with people and institutions. And when you talk about getting this message that it's not okay to be a mom after 40, well, it's definitely not okay to get old, and it's definitely not okay to have wrinkles. And those messages come at us from a culture that places white men's experience at the top of the heap in all their privilege, and that those of us who are not, you know, it's not that white men don't have lots of challenges too, but they don't face the kind of institutionalized discrimination that women do, that women of color do more than white women, that people with disabilities, et cetera, all these forms of discrimination compound and reinforce each other. You know, I'm sure society wanted you to have 18 children by the time you were 30, so you were a little slow getting off the mark.
So I'm guessing also that, you know, the precipitator for a lot of women is just this 10-year period of perimenopause or menopause, which unfortunately for men, they don't have that opportunity to really have to pause and give reflection or even find a renewal. In a lot of cases, they're just steamrolling ahead. Would you agree?
I do think so. And, you know, I think a lot of women are trying to do the same. And, you know, there are tremendous consumer forces. If aging is framed as a problem, then we can be convinced to buy stuff to fix it. And if aging is a disease, then we can be persuaded to buy stuff to cure it. And there's discussion about whether perimenopause, for example, is even a real thing, which is, I'm not saying that the symptoms aren't real, but to medicalize it as a stage that is somehow a problem and requires treatment. Another example would be something called mild cognitive impairment. There is a lot of discussion around, which is when you can't remember the name of the movie you saw with what's-her-name last week. Is that really a disease? Do we really need to be worried about it? Do we really need to buy pills and potions and brain training stuff to fix it? Or should we just accept that this is happening? For men, of course, there's also hormone replacement therapy. A lot of guys, you know, you get older, your testosterone decreases. After menopause, it increases in women. And one of the interesting paradoxes that people talk about is, and this is a, you know, huge generalization, but that older women after menopause, Margaret Mead famously said, there is nothing like the zest of the postmenopausal woman. You know, that women become sort of more forceful, if you will. I hate to speak in such gendered stereotype terms. And men perhaps become a little softer and a little more in tune with their feminine side so that the sexes become more alike, which I think is just a gorgeous idea. And you see it playing out in the sexual arena. You know, if sex stops being less about erections and duration and starts being more about slow pleasure and whole body and communication, your sex can be better as we age, especially for women. And for men, too, but they, of course, face the really difficult task of disengaging their ego from how hard and how long they can have intercourse, which is, frankly, not, in my experience and that of my friends, not for a lot of women where the deepest pleasure lies.
Sure. So what do you think about this time in our lives? Why now? Why these issues? Why in our society? What does this why mean to you? And do you think we're accomplishing anything regarding ageism?
You know, that's a big question. I mean, ageism really is the last socially sanctioned prejudice, although horrifyingly, since the election, I feel less confident saying that because it seems as though other forms of bigotry, which we sort of thought we had shown a light on and said were not acceptable, are suddenly emergent again or being given a pass, which is really terrible. I think that the biggest force raising awareness of ageism now, and it's very definitely happening. There are organizations cropping up. The fact that this PBS site chose me as the influencer of the year, there are amazing people on that list who have all sorts of degrees, who have worked in the aging field their whole lives. The reason they chose me, I'm pretty sure, is because I'm focused uniquely on ageism, and it's an acknowledgement that whether you work in the field or you're just getting older and want to do it in a conscious way that is not burdened by needless dread and needless segregation, you need to think about ageism, just as if you want to be a conscious woman in the world, you need to think about sexism, right? I mean, So I think that as the baby boom, I'm dead center in the boom, you know, there's a paradox there, too. We are healthiest. The healthiest generation in history. We are also the wealthiest. We're incredibly fortunate historically. And there is this sense of, gee, we're different than our parents were, which is true. We are aging in a different way to some degree. But I think there's also a lot of denial. If I eat enough kale and keep skiing and keep whatever, we're driving a sports car, I can stop the clock. And nobody can stop the clock. So my theory is that it's starting to dawn on my generation that you cannot stop the clock and that you're a lot better off if you can actually look at aging and all its diversity. You know, an ageist culture casts it entirely in terms of loss. There is loss of beloved friends and there is loss of physical function. There are no other certainties. And, of course, there are other losses depending on our individual circumstance, but there's also gains. It's also additive. The epigraph to my book is a quote from Anne Lamott, which is, "We contain all the ages we have ever been." You know, we live in horror of, in an ageist culture of, like, waking up old or when I'm not old. You know, people say this. I mean, someone said to me at a talk recently, "My mom's 92, but she's not old." Well, what the hell is she if she's not old? She's a million other things, of course. The point being that there is no old-young divide after which it's all downhill, and that imaginary divide segregates us and fills us with needless dread. And all prejudices operate to pit people against each other and protect the status quo, which, one look at the new cabinet, protects the interests of white men. So the more we can join forces across all these forms of discrimination, the better.
What do you think we've accomplished in the last 10 or 20 years regarding ageism? And moving forward, what changes do you expect to see, given that you just framed it as we're living longer, we're the baby boomers, we have more money, now what? Where are we in this continuum of changing these mores?
I think 10 years ago, we were in the dark ages. It still astonishes me how many people have not even heard the word ageism. The flip side of that, of course, is that we have come very far, very fast, because there is, the minute I say to someone something that seems, you know, blindingly obvious, for example, age is a criterion for diversity. The light goes off and you can see someone saying, well, that makes sense. So there are a lot of aha moments. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit. Once people start to see ageism, they see it everywhere, also because it is relevant to everyone, because everyone ages. And I think, you know, the culture has come an awful long way in just, I mean, look how fast we've come in terms of gay rights in this century alone, but also in terms of women's rights, in terms of civil rights. There is a broad-based awareness in the culture at large, even in corporate culture, that diversity is a good thing. And that is what is propelling this movement forward with enormous speed. I mean, there are organizations cropping up. There's just the reception to my ideas and my book. There are more people starting to talk about it. I don't have a Geiger counter. I can't give you a count on how many people are more aware of ageism than they were last week. But I can tell you that when my ideas hit, they catch fire because people understand that it has resonance for them personally, and we understand that we want a more diverse culture, not just across race and gender identity and disability, but also across age. It is an intuitively obvious idea. It's about justice. It's about equity. And its time has come because of all these social forces swirling around us. After the election, I found myself wondering whether the struggle against ageism was kind of a first world problem when there seemed so many other forms of discrimination racism in particular, that were calling out rightfully for our attention. And what I realized, you know, both sadly and happily, is you don't have to choose. All these forms of discrimination reinforce each other, but any form of activism helps undo the foundation for all of them, right? If you make the world better to grow old in, you make it a better place in which to be female, to have a disability, to have less money, etc. And that if we show up at all ages for whatever our cause happens to be, save the whales, you know, save the Supreme Court, whatever it is, if you look around the table and everyone is the same age, you're not being as effective as you can be. And a fantastic example is marches, you know, where you really do get all ages in the street and it feels powerful and organic and natural, which it is. So if there are all groups around the table for whatever the cause happens to be, that in that way we dismantle ageism organically from within in the process of fighting these other struggles.
So let me play devil's advocate for a second. When you advocate for equal opportunities at any age, does that mean that it extends to life choices such as choosing motherhood over 50 or 60? Does that mean that people can work until any age they choose? I mean, does that literally blow off the gatekeepers and the walls that have heretofore been in existence?
You know, I would less say equal opportunities at every age as equal rights. I know that's a little touchy-feely, but I think where I really get my back up is the idea that the rights of a human being, the value of a human being, should diminish over time. And I will say that even if you are lying in a hospital bed, tethered to, you know, machines requiring a lot of expensive support. A lot of those people are young people who got in bad accidents or who were unlucky enough to develop a chronic condition early in life. As we age, we become more different from one another, which is we all age at different rates, socially, cognitively, and physically. So I think your question is interesting theoretically, but in practical application, not actually valid, because a few older people are going to want to keep working to the end. And that's a complicated question, but it's a fallacy that older people take jobs away from younger people because they don't typically compete for the same jobs and because the amount of labor is not fixed, for example. It's called the fallacy of the lump of labor. You can look it up. So it's cast by the culture in this old versus young way, which is a straw man. Okay, it's like pitting working women, working moms who work outside the home against moms who stay home. The real issue is joining together to get subsidized childcare, subsidized caregiving, and close the damn wage gap. And we all women need to join forces against that. So I think the opportunities across the lifespan necessarily change as we, you know, when we're young. Age is real. Differences between young people, younger people and older people need to be recognized and respected, but not used as a tool to pit our interests against each other. Because, again, all that does is protect a status quo that advantages the rich, the white, and the male.
So let's turn our sights to what's the difference between men and women in this manner?
My first book was really written for and about women. Although it's not, which was about why women who end their marriages do so well, in no way an anti-man book. I love men, but it was about why it's hard to have an egalitarian marriage in a culture that treats men and women differently, which disadvantages all the husbands out there who want to have an egalitarian marriage, right? It's the social surround. Yep. It's not that we are stupid or weak or not blonde enough or don't have big enough boobs. It's the culture that says if you don't have these things, you are lesser. Right? We need to constantly look at the culture. So men and women do experience aging differently in some regards. And the reason is, again, looking at the culture. First of all, the way it is now, younger women maintain power by distancing themselves from older women. And older women try desperately to hold on to power by trying to look young, and there are air quotes around that because you can only look the age you are, obviously. There's no such thing as looking young, or acting your age, right? That's no such thing. That's a stereotype. It doesn't take a PhD in feminist studies to realize that these behaviors reinforce the idea that appearance is the most important thing about us. They set us up to fail, right? Because no one can stay young, whatever the metric is. and they pit us against each other. So I just gave a new talk about this, which urges women to look at the surround. What makes men and women experience aging differently is this consumer culture, that this patriarchal culture that values your appearance above all and places your worth and how, you know, whether you're attractive enough to cut it in terms of the male gaze and social power. Huge issue, of course, economics, the wage gap. Women earn less, therefore we save less, therefore we're poorer in old age, etc. Caregiving. Women get stuck with most of the caregiving, which is a joy and a delight when there is support for it, but there is neither financial nor cultural support for it. And all these burdens are further compounded by race and class. And health. Women are sicker. We live longer. We have less money. We require more care. So all these structural forces combine to make aging more difficult and more fraught for women. Where it all begins, of course, which we know from, you know, we know from 1,000 self-help groups. We know from consciousness-raising groups of the women's movement. We know from the body acceptance movement. It all starts between our ears. To look at ourselves and think about where are these voices coming from that say, you're ugly, you're fat, you're unattractive, you're unworthy. They come from the culture. So look at where they come and what purpose they serve. And of course, that purpose is to make us buy stuff we don't need, to treat this powerful, natural, beautiful process as an illness or an affliction when it is a source of, you know, of difficulties. I'm no Pollyanna about the whole thing, but also the norm. I mean, as we age, we get more confident. We get more relaxed. We care less about what people think, which is fantastically liberating for women in particular, who are conditioned to be pleasing to men. You know, and we want less, which is really great. So let's tell both sides of the story and let's look at where the messages that say this is not so come from and what interests they serve, because those interests are not our friend.
So what are some of the tips you would offer the listener to trying to confront their own personal demons with regard to getting older?
You know, the first and essential step, and it is uncomfortable, is to look at our own bias, because to look for ways in which you are ageist instead of for evidence that you aren't, because we can't challenge bias unless we're aware of it, and everyone is biased all the time. You know, I catch myself thinking ageist stuff all the time. My book, it has almost 100 5-stars reviews on Amazon. It has all my thoughts in it. It has a whole chapter on how to stand up. I would look first at your own attitudes, and when you say, I feel old, for example, or, you know, I'm not old, what do you really mean by that? You might mean that you feel sexy, or you feel energetic, or you feel competent. Those are feelings we can feel at any age, just as we can feel, you know, ugly and like a loser as an adolescent, right? So look at language and whether you use old and young as all-purpose placeholders, and try and break that habit and use the actual word that describes how you actually feel. And once you start to see it, it's like a genie getting out of a bottle or something just shifting a little on its axis. Once you start to see it in the culture, and that's the function of my Yo Is This Ageist blog, it's where people can take pictures or report something that they saw or heard and say, is it ageist? It's not always ageist. Age is real. There are real differences in, treatments and conditions for people. But it often is. But this is such a new idea in the culture that often people don't know. And if someone says something ageist to you, I mean, a favorite example is an older friend of mine. She came into a party. She'd been away for a while, and someone said, I can't believe you're still up and around. Now, what on earth is she supposed to say to that? But being a fantastic person and an age scholar, she said, what do you mean by that? And let it just hang there. So that's a really good thing. Why would you call me young lady? You know, and just not in an obnoxious way. Someone, you know, if someone says, you look great for your age, you say, you look great for your age too. And just force the person to reflect for a minute on what they said and why it doesn't feel like a compliment. Because it's in little moments like that that we shift people's awareness. But again, it has to come from between their ears and between your ears.
And what final tip would you like to leave the listener with today?
Be less afraid. You know, fear makes us stupid. and fear makes us compete. I'm developing a workshop called You Will Look Like Us to bring younger and older women together, because to discuss this, you know, this really screwed up dynamic of competition in which we just dig the hole deeper by competing to stay young. And I say, do we want to dig it deeper or throw away the damn shovel and figure out new ways of collaborating? Because I think, you know, and the most important step, thank you for asking this question, is to have friends of all ages. Because when younger women are around older women, they see that, you know, yeah, we have crow's feet, but that's not the end of the world. And we're in the world in all kinds of interesting ways. And they are less afraid. And that, I think, makes them more willing to let go of their social advantage over us and to see it in terms of collaborating, because the way it is now, you know, we're in this endless chain, and it's time to break that chain and develop. I know it's a big ask, but it's really essential. Let go of this needless fear of aging. Stop competing against our fellow woman on terms that are just terrible, that do nothing but further entrench ageism and sexism and patriarchy, and work together for a version of sisterhood that does not leave older women out and does not leave women of color out and does not leave people with disabilities out. We have the opportunity, the amazing opportunity, to start a movement now that is truly inclusive. And it's not up to me. It's up to every person out there, not just women. It's up to all of us out there. If you want a better future for yourself, if you want to be less afraid, when I started this project, I floundered for a long time, and I said to myself, if all I get out of this is feeling so much better about the years ahead, that's got to be enough. And, you know, it is enough. If that's all you get out of it is that you realize, geez, I am so much more afraid than I should be, that's fantastic. And carry that out in the world.
We've been talking today to writer and activist Ashton Applewhite about ageism and experiencing ageism, internal ageism, ageism in the media. She can be found at This Chair Rocks. The same name as her book, This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. Thank you so much, Ashton, for joining me today. This was delightful.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40, Conversations with Sima. Thank you to the listener for joining me today. And until next time, I hope you take care.